On Sunday, August 21st at 11 p.m., Shivan Mahbul memorializes pianist and revolutionary artist Connie Crothers. Join us as our guest contributor Chris Becker, author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, interviews Connie Crothers along with remembrances from drummer-percussionist Warren Smith, trumpeter Louis Flip Barnes, and festival organizer Patricia Nicholson Parker. That's Sunday, August 21st at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Shugan Mahbul is the name of this program, and tonight is a memorial broadcast for pianist Connie Crothers. And I'd like to thank the community of musicians and writers and artists. This community of ours really helped put this program together, especially Chris Becker. In March, heard Chris talk about his latest book, Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, and Connie Crothers is actually the cover girl on the book, and fortunately, he recorded that interview, and he shared that with us for this evening's broadcast, so stay tuned. I'd also like to thank Patricia Nicholson Parker, Arts for Art, and Vision Festival organizer, Warren Smith, percussionist, drummer, and Louis Flip Barnes, trumpeter and composer, all around great people, for contributing their remembrances of Connie Crothers. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Shugan Mahbul continues.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar. My
for taking time to speak with me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, I'm appreciative of this. You know, I have something to tell you about this. I've always been very, very aware of the lack of regard for women musicians in jazz. And I was early in the women's movement, like in the very early 60s, when practically nobody was really aware or interested. And I've seen enormous changes since then, but there's still a lag within jazz. And through all these years, I have been outspoken whenever anybody was interested, not on a crusade, I'm not like that, but just to say what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really been included in women in jazz events. So I just feel happy that you contacted me, because I definitely want to be a participant.
It's wonderful. My friend Flip Barnes, the trumpet player.
Yes, of course. We're going to play together.
Oh, wow. I'd love to hear that.
He's called me about a project that he wants to do with me.
He's such an incredible improviser and player.
He's a wonderful person. He's terrific.
He strongly suggested I contact you. One of many reasons being your work and your artistry also sort of connects a lot of the artists that I've already interviewed for the project. A lot of what you do is really kind of a bridge between a lot of the different worlds that I've been exploring through these interviews. So,
one thing before we start that's in connection with what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, the jazz world was sort of divided into groups based on considerations that were just kind of put in place however they were. Like, for example, there was a kind of division between the free improvisers and the jazz musicians who played tunes, for example, and other divisions based on other considerations. And now we're moving into a new era, actually. I feel that it's already underway. Certainly it is in New York City. And that is, I call it a jazz renaissance, but it's happening underground, not on the surface. But the thing that I think has to happen in order for this to come to fruition is that all the groups need to open up and find out about each other, because there are so many valuable musicians in each group. And if they find out about each other, the art form will just blossom. So I look forward to that. I hope to be a part of that. In fact, in a way I am, because I'm in several of them now. You know, it's like I have friends, musicians, and associates in more than one of these groups at present, which is my great joy.
You know, what you just said reminded me of a quote I heard from you in one of the interviews I was checking out. And you described jazz as an evolving art form. And you just mentioned that this renaissance, this evolution, is taking place underground. Are we talking about outside of academia, outside of the university instruction?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, but also outside of the mainstream venues as well. Some of the leading proponents of this jazz renaissance are still unknown.
Thank you.
I go back and ask you about your first days or your earliest days as a musician, going back to maybe to even your childhood? When did you first begin playing a musical instrument? How old were you?
9.
Was it the piano?
Yes.
Were you taking formal lessons?
Oh, geez. My grandmother, who was like my mother, she bought a piano with an old upright. And everybody did that in those years, you know. And she had a friend who taught piano lessons. And so I studied with her friend, who was studying with a teacher who, in the Bay Area, that's near San Francisco, was the most highly reputed teacher. And she got me a scholarship, so I studied with him. And it was only classical music. And from the time that I was 9, like right away, before I started studying with him, as soon as I started getting to a piano, I was writing my own pieces for this teacher who presented me a lot in recitals and concerts, would want me to have my pieces on my programs. So from the time I was, 12 to 15, I was performing quite a lot.
Oh, wow.
Big works, you know. It's like I look at my programs now, and it's kind of, I used to play 3 sets of big works, Beethoven and Bach and Chopin and some of the more modern composers, Ravel and Debussy, and then there were my own pieces also included on the program. Now, I didn't keep any of them. I should have done that, but, you know, I just didn't think that much of it at the time, except at the time, even when I was a child, I realized that I did not want to spend my life performing other people's music. As much as I love these pieces, I realized that that would never fulfill me, that I was going to have to create my own music. So when I was 12 years old, I gave up composing. And the reason why I gave it up was because I realized that the idiom that I was familiar with was not current. I didn't feel it had contemporary value. And so I just let it go. And I didn't get back with it until I was in my late teens.
What struck you about your music that made you decide that it wasn't contemporary or it wasn't representing what it is you wanted to play or what you thought you had the capability to play at the piano?
I knew that it was not a contemporary idiom. You know, mostly I was hearing the kind of music that was composed in the 19th century.
When did you begin improvising at the piano?
That's a good question. When I was in my late teens, I went back into music and seriously, with the idea in mind to become a composer. I went to the University of California at Berkeley, and while I was there, still an undergraduate, I audited graduate courses, and I studied privately with a Berkeley composer, and I attended all of the performances. So I was extremely serious, and I composed while I was there. But I also knew pretty quickly that it was not for me, because during those years, certainly, it was very much about procedure, and I could be interested in it, but I didn't think that's what music was for. Like, for me, always, music was the reason we have it, is to express feeling. And that wasn't going on in the Berkeley environment. It was about procedure. It was about structure. The favorite phrase, instead of feeling or beauty, was compositional rigor. So it was just not for me. So I thought, well, I don't know anything about jazz, but it's the other great art music of our time, and so I'll find out about it. And I listened to the radio. I bought a few records, and I didn't really get a handle on it. I studied with an arranger, a local radio personality named Cousineau, really terrific guy, but that didn't get it for me either. But then I heard a track by Lenny Tristano, Requiem. Thank you. 4 minutes, but during the length of that track, I had an amazing experience, which is that I saw my future. It was unnerving because I had a very wonderful, happy life in California that I did not want to leave. And I knew nothing about New York City. I knew nothing about improvising or about jazz, but I knew that's what was going to happen. So it was almost as if it had already happened. It was a very incredible experience. So I started trying to find out about improvisation during a lesson with, because there was music in the background, and I knew it was Lenny. I wanted him to turn it up. It was C minor complex. About it, and I said, now I know that's not improvised because I had a way of knowing, because I was a composer, you know, not as a jazz composer, but I knew about that, and I also was a piano player, so I knew enough to know that the musical complexity and also the pianistic demands were way past what anybody could do if they were improvising. I just knew that had to be composed. Of course, he set me straight right away. He said, every note on that is improvised. When he said that to me, it made a believer out of me. That's what I wanted. Lisa came into the area and advertised at UC Police, so I called him and took 4 month lessons with him, which showed me that I could not procrastinate for any reason. I had to leave right away and come to New York City. He was very gracious and he taught me some important things, but I knew that it wasn't going to work, that I couldn't settle. I had to just do it. And that's what got me here. Now, I'm leaving out something, which is the answer to your question. When I realized that I wanted to improvise, I sat down at my piano and said to myself, now, improvise. And I sat there for about a half hour. All I could do was stare at the keys. I could not improvise. This really made me angry because I thought, with all of my many years of training and the ability that I did develop during those years, I could, in fact, really play big works. I mean, I could do it. I even knew by then that those classical composers were also improvisers. So I realized that that had been left out of my training, and it just was a shock to me. Classical training, in those years certainly, developed that. Like I've dealt with this in my own teaching, classical players who get boxed in and they can't improvise. The thing that I credit myself for is that while I was sitting there wanting to do this, I didn't just fake it. I knew I couldn't do it. And I didn't fake it. So it was a moment of truth for me. So when I came to New York City, I didn't even really know if I could improvise. I just knew what I had to do. It all worked out. It's amazing what such a huge, I don't know how to describe this. I'm like I was catapulted into my future and really knew what it was going to be. Like it had already happened. So it was an amazing experience. And it all worked out. It proved to be true.
So did you go to New York and get Lenny Tristano's... How did you connect with him as a teacher? Was that the next step?
Well, Lee Curtis called him and recommended me.
Okay, great.
As soon as I got to New York City, I started studying with him.
Now, because of your teaching, what are some practical instructions you offer to your students who want to begin improvising?
Number one, sing with records.
Is this what Lenny had you do, though?
Sing with records. This is what Lenny told me. He told me that when he first started to teach, he had great students. He had Lee Konitz studying with him when Lee was a teenager, Bill Russo. And he knew a lot of theory, and he could present it very well. And his students did very well. But he said to me, in those earlier years, what wasn't happening was spontaneous improvisation. They could learn all the things very well. But what wasn't happening was the kind of spontaneous improvisation that he knew about. And then he discovered singing with records, and he said, that's what opened it up. So Lenny told me he felt that was the greatest discovery of his teaching life. Now, when I say this to people who don't know about this, it doesn't compute. They don't get it. And I don't think there's any other teacher, certainly not that I know about, who has this idea and will present it to students. And that baffles me because it is beyond belief effective. It's incredibly effective. Now, when I present this to my students, I like to recommend to them that they start out with the musicians in the first decades of this music for a number of reasons. One of them is we all need our roots. It goes back before John Coltrane. It even goes back before Charlie Parker. People have to find out what we came from. We need our lineage. And then beyond that, during those first few decades of this music, there was a different energy, and all the musicians were in this energy. And I think some of it is because they never stopped playing. That improvisation energy was more open than it is today. Now, there have been outstanding individuals, of course, innovators since then. But I like to say that if you really want to find out about spontaneous improvisation, that's the single strongest, best way. Do a lot of singing with people like Louis Armstrong, Roy Eldridge, Lester Young, Billie Holiday, Charlie Christian, like in those years, and then move on to Charlie Parker and Bud Powell. And, you know, it's like I have a whole roster of musicians that I like to suggest. Or I will say to people, if a solo reaches for you, sing with that one because it has a personal meaning. Beyond that, I don't teach in the academic way about improvisation. So my approach is not based on people putting melodic material into chord changes. I feel that's false. That's not improvisation. It's a substitute. And now people commonly understand it as improvisation. But in fact, it's not. So what I get to instead with people is to have them play the straight melody of a tune with no ornamentation or not like on a sheet music, but the way they would sing it. Very simple. And then instead of trying to think chords, just hear the melody and let the melodic line get released. from the melody as your source. So I like to say the melody has everything in it. It has a harmonic sound, so you're getting the harmony from your ear rather than thinking C7. And then besides that, the melody of the tune has the form. If you internalize the melody of the tune, you don't have to count beats and bars. You don't have to be cognizant of your sections. The melody gives the whole thing to you. And when you release your improvisation after that point, you can bring in anything. If you start thinking chords before you release your improvisation, it's like trying to fly with a weight on you. It doesn't happen. You're going to be stuck with thinking chords for the rest of your playing life, in fact.
Thank you.
I have helped people get out of that. It's like a straitjacket. They come in through the door realizing that they've hit a wall. It's like chord changes with bits of melody and chord scales can get you complicated music, but it's limited. There's a limit to it. But if you contact spontaneous improvisation, that's boundless. It stretches out infinitely. I could say one other thing, because I told you how I begin, where I start. And like the thing about singing with records and playing simple melodies, I present that to very advanced musicians. It's not just for beginners, it's for everybody. Here's one of my premises. Simple and complex are identical. The opposite of simple is complicated. So it follows from that that anything that's complicated cannot be complex. So I get musicians into being able to contact whatever they work on from the simplest expression. So the simplest expression of a tune is the melody. My own musical work and the way I work with people who study with me is not predetermined in any way, and it's open. So when I say spontaneous improvisation, I'm open to everything. So I don't believe in mistakes. I encourage people to improvise freely, and when they're playing from a melody on a tune, to accept what they might think of as wrong notes. And with more advanced people, I open it up for them to improvise while remaining deeply within the tune, to improvise with harmony. So I don't believe in honoring the harmony. And I think it's the mistake with the chord changes approach to teaching. You listen all around town, and no matter what the content is, if they're playing a tune that's been played, you know, like you hear the same harmony, you may hear variations of it, and it honors the sections too much. It's like, no wonder people want to throw out standards. I'd be sick of them also if that's what I was doing. But, yeah, but it's amazing. But if you grasp the real concept of spontaneous improvisation, everything is there. For example, there's been a huge chasm between the standard tunes players and the free improvisers for decades, and this really worked against me because I have always done both from the beginning. My first performance, I had both going on. So I kind of caught it from both sides. Not so much now, but certainly when I was coming up, like the free improvisers thought that if you play tunes, it's not pure improvisation. And the tunes players thought if you do any free improvisation, well, that's just bull. But in my opinion, that's the next step for this music, to take that huge wall that separates those two modes of improvisation and just throw it away, get rid of it. Because in my opinion, those two modes of improvisation merge, and the next evolution of this music is going to express that. And then Lenny Tristano, who was the first person to go into the recording studio with this in mind, he had free improvising sessions with his band 3 times a week for 2 years before they took it into the club. They did this in Birdland and on the bandstand every night. They played tunes and they also did some free improvisation. So, you know, the separation of those two modes of expression is a mistake. And when we wake up to that and let them converge as they naturally do, that's our next level. I can't even begin to imagine the music that's going to result from that, except, of course, I've tapped into that.
Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program, and we have been broadcasting a pianist, Connie Carruthers, memorial broadcast. Many thanks to Chris Becker for providing the audio of the interview that he conducted with Connie Carruthers in April of 2013. What we're listening to right now in the background is Three Way, and that is from Connie Crothers' debut release as a leader, Perception. It's a 1974 Steeplechase Records release. Connie Crothers on piano, Jackie McLean on alto sax, Joe Solomon on bass, and Roger Mancuso on drums. Before that, we heard In a Sentimental Mood from Connie Crothers with Jessica Jones. This is from Live at the Freight, 2013 New Artist Records release. Connie Crothers on piano and Jessica Jones on tenor saxophone. Before that, we heard Requiem from Lenny Tristano. The name of the release is Lenny Tristano, 1956 Atlantic Records. Before that, we heard, yes, it's actually G Minor Complex, and that is from the new Tristano, 1962 Atlantic Records release, Lenny Tristano on solo piano. Before that, we heard Lenny's Scene from Connie Crothers' Perception, Steeplechase, 1974. Before that, we heard To Be Continued by Connie Crothers and Bill Payne from Conversations. That's a 2007 New Artist Records release. Connie Crothers on piano, Bill Payne on clarinet. And before that, we have our theme by Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from a compilation, The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is an RCA BMG compilation, originally recorded in 1967. This compilation was released in 1998. Stay tuned for our associate producer, Hank Williams, and his On the Bandstand segment, and we will continue with more conversation between Chris Becker, author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, and Connie Crothers. We will hear remembrances from Warren Smith, Patricia Nicholson Parker, and Lewis Flip Barnes, right here on Sugar in My Bowl, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Jazz fans, this is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for August 21st. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show is a memorial to the late pianist Connie Crothers. We're awaiting info for a memorial service, but we'll definitely pass it on when we get some information. But right now we have music listings for you. We start this week with vibraphonist Roy Ayers, who is on the Smooth Jazz Cruise on the 24th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls, and that's also on the 24th. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band at Grant's Tomb for a free outdoor performance as part of the Jazzmobile series, and that's on the 24th as well. Percussionist Steve Croon is at the Louis Armstrong House and Museum in Queens for a free outdoor performance, and that's part of the Jazzmobile series, and that's on the 25th. Guitarist Julian Lage is at the Stone with fellow guitarist Nels Klein on the 25th. Pianist and keyboardist Mark Carey hosts the Harlem Sessions at Ginny's Supper Club in Harlem on the 25th. Poet and vocalist Abiodun Oyewole is at the Nerican Poets Cafe at the Acoustic Vibes Show on the 26th. Pianist Randy Weston leads the African Rhythms Ensemble with bassist Alex Blake at the Charlie Parker Jazz Festival in Marcus Garvey Park on the 27th. Drummer Will Calhoun performs with Living Color at the Afropunk Festival in Brooklyn's Commodore Barry Park, and that's on the 28th. Drummer Antonio Sanchez leads his migration group with vocalist Tana Alexa at the Jazz Standard from September 1st through 4th. Finally, percussionist Steve Kroon is at the Side Door in Old Lyme, Connecticut on September 3rd. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can. Consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website for details. And a huge thanks to all of you who supported the station during the recent fund drive. We literally could not do it without you. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, September 4th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
And what you're talking about a pretty high level of musicianship, though. You have to have a lot of facility.
Oh, yes. Okay. People have to give their lives to developing their understanding of music. The 2011 Vision Festival, I played a set with my quartet. Richard Tabnick is the saxophone player. Ken Filiano is the bassist. Roger Mancuso is the drummer. And we agreed ahead of time that what we were going to do is we chose some tunes we have heads for. And we were going to play the heads during the set. And then there would be implied, of course, the tune. But what we agreed was that any one of the four of us at any time could drop the tune and go into free improvisation. So we didn't even say that we will do this at selected time, like play the head, play a chorus or two of the tune, and then play free. We could do this at any time, like any musician, for example, could freely improvise even when we were still in the head, and this would be entirely open. And this really worked.
Yeah.
It worked even more than I thought it would. When I'm saying heads, they're not the tune, you know, like these are heads that I wrote. They're like parts from the tune in every respect. So the head expresses one thing, and then we associate it with a tune that we like. It's not like I've just written like a melodic statement over some changes. Quite the contrary. It's more like an association.
It's really wonderful to talk about jazz in terms of its potential to become something that maybe people haven't heard before. And I think that's really important because it resonates with this project and similar projects I'm seeing where the look at history and the look at what's going on in contemporary music now is shifting more to where more women are being included in the conversation.
When I first came to New York City, this was before the women's movement, I got here in 1962. When I went to a club, it was like walking a gauntlet. It was just seeing, you know, if there was a woman on premises, you're going to hit on her.
Yeah.
And it just went on. Now this is called sexual harassment. In those years, it was considered to be, that's how it is.
Yeah.
So no one gave it any thought. I heard from a good source that Lester Young's sister, Irma Young, quit her music for that reason when she got married. Now, a lot of women in those years were kept off of bandstands and out of the record dates because of the prevailing notion, which was very strong then, that men were better, that women were not as good as men. If you thought that way, it was considered hip.
Yeah.
But it was also this sexual harassment that was very intense. But the exceptions were the guys that I met who were studying with Lenny who were in my generation. They were not like that at all. So I met both Roger Mancuso, who's in my band today, in those years. That was completely absent from him. He related to me as a musician right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Lenny Popkin, the tenor player. But then it moved away from that into an era when, though that could still go on, it was not as open and not as acceptable. But what I noticed for decades was almost like an unwritten rule. Any women on the bandstand? One. No more than one. This was even true if it was a singer's group. The singer, if she was a woman, that would be the only woman. And now, this is changing. And it's changing, especially among the younger women. There are bands where there are a few women, or maybe the band is mostly women. This is a major change. I had a band for a long time, which featured Carol Tristano. She's a great drummer. And it was a band that I co-led with Lenny Popkin. For the most part, we performed with Cameron Brown. And so there were two of us. Carol, like me, is not big in stature, and she's very sweet. She used to walk out on the bandstand and sit down at the kit, and she had this sweet expression, and you could feel it, you know? Like the audience would just think, oh, well, I'm not going to get much from this drummer. She's a little chick. And then she would take her first solo, and the whole place would break up. So, you know, audiences are more receptive than people give them credit for.
Mm-hmm.
The audiences had no problem with her. As soon as they heard her cut loose with a solo, they got it. Here's a great drummer. In this music, there have been, like, hundreds and even thousands of great women musicians. An example that comes immediately to my mind was Vi Rent, who I think is one of the most important alto saxophone players in this music. People never even heard of her, mostly.
I haven't heard of her.
I could go down a long list, you know. It's like, but now, this is changing, and it's changing mostly among the younger musicians. You get outstanding musicians like Ingrid Laubrook and also Mary Alverson, and they're in a group together. And who thinks anything of that? Nobody. Major change. Here's another outstanding woman I'd like to mention. Mary Osborne. She's one of the most important musicians in jazz because she's the missing link between Charlie Christian and the guitar players who came afterwards.
There's almost always some music written or at least pre-planned that serves as the base for improvisation. For instance, you know that Gershwin tune, The Man I Love. Right away, jazz musicians would add some interpretive touches. Embellish a few notes. Change the sense of phrasing slightly. Play with a melody line. Give it that hard to define rhythmic feel we call swing. But let me show you how the great jazz guitarist Mary Osborne does it. She's playing here in a 1958 television show. First, Mary gives her own interpretation of the melody. Thank you. the tempo shifts into what we call double time, and Mary begins to improvise variations on the theme. By the way, do you recognize the woman next to Mary? It's the legendary Billie Holiday. Wasn't it? Just some improvisation on an old popular tune. But Mary got so much out of it. It was almost as if she was opening the tune up to see what it was made of. And what she found, she used for her improvisation.
The missing link that the historians have been seeking is her, Charlie Christian's only protege. She's major. Billie Holiday hired her for that TV special. She's in the part of the TV special that they never show. Billie knew about her and hired her, so there was two women in that band. I'd like to mention one more woman. Louis Armstrong's Hot Five originally was Lil Hardin's band. She was the band leader. Not only was she a band leader, she was a promoter. She did promotion for Louis. She got him away from Fletcher Henderson. And the rest is history, right? Lil, she was a middle-class person, and she was valedictorian of her graduating class, and her family didn't want her to do this. Bear in mind, when she was in the Hot Five, she was still in her 20s. She was an extremely accomplished musician and jumped over hurdles in order to accomplish what she did. But after she broke up with Louis, that was it for her. What she did has got to be a cornerstone of this music, because though Louis was with Fletcher, it wasn't like he wasn't up performing. But Fletcher was the most important band in the country then, maybe even more than Duke at that time. Louis left Fletcher to join Lil's band, and then it became Louis' band. Rightly so. I mean, Louis Armstrong, as far as I'm concerned, is like the big bang in this music. Still, it was her band, and she put him out there and kind of got in front of everybody's face that he was the one.
If you're a young person and you go to college and you see this being reinforced, this negative stereotyping, a skewed version of history, well, you don't know any better. You're like, well, I'm in college, so this must be correct, right? You know, this. I see my teacher behaving this way, then this is okay, right? But we're talking about change here, too. Like you, I'm excited at this potential, and I see it, too.
We're moving.
Exactly.
Jazz is not dead. Jazz has not gotten hasn't stopped. In fact, we're heading into something incredible going on all the time around here. I get surprised all the time by individual performances. Walk in, and I don't know what I'm going to be hearing. I can be hearing something I never heard before.
My last question here, we'll get down to the economics of survival these days as an independent musician. Say a young person comes to you and says, I want to play music. You know they want to play it as well as they possibly can. They want to dig in, they want to do it, and they're not necessarily interested in playing something that's commercial, playing something that is anything but who they are.
The only kind of student I get.
Does the question of, you know, there are some musicians I've interviewed whose parents were horrified when they said, well, I want to be a musician. I had one person tell me their parents said, no, you should become a dentist, you know, a great bass player. Is this a subject you get into with your students, any kind of like preparing them in any way how to deal with this, how to find time to play,
everybody,
how to pay the bills?
Everybody. Everyone has this problem. It's not a new problem. There was a little money in jazz for a while, and that's dropped out. But originally, there really wasn't a whole lot of money. Jazz in the first few decades was supported by the gangsters. They were like the Medici. But when they stopped supporting jazz, there wasn't really any money. If you got a good gig in a festival, you know, or went on a European tour, you could get some money. But there never has been much money for jazz musicians in this country. And any jazz musician who gets a good gig is going to have a few months where maybe there are no good gigs. That's always been true. There's this old saying that jazz musicians know about, good enough for jazz. There's some truth in that because of all the different musical forms, maybe, jazz is the one that gets treated the worst. I'm not going to go into a speech about that subject, but I want to make a simple point. There is this saying, it's like a kind of a little joke in a way. It's like a tourist is walking down the street in New York City, and he stops a New York City person and says, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the New York City person says, practice, practice, practice. So people know what this joke means. And it is a musician's life, and especially a jazz musician, because I don't know about the classical musicians' performing life. They have to put in a lot of time, too. But when you're a jazz musician, you have a steeper challenge because you have to create your music at the very same split second that you're performing it. That's an amazing challenge. In order to be able to do that with any depth and reality, you've got to spend tremendous quantities of time, not just in the beginning, but all your life. And none of the time that you spend is paid. None of it. Now, you can pick up gigs, but they're not going to pay your rent. So almost every jazz musician I have ever known had other ways of bringing in income. So, like, for example, even an amazingly successful, all his life, he was on the top of the profession, Max Roach, worked at UMass. Lenny was a teacher, of course. The one exception I'm thinking of now is Roy Eldridge. I don't think that he had another job, but he told me, there were lean times. During one period of his life, he considered becoming a radio technician. So all of the musicians have this problem, and that's in the core. And it's in the core of life for all artists, which is the enormous amount of time that you must bring to it, to be any good at it, is not paid. So at the very same time that your professional counterpart are coming up in their profession, they're getting paid. And you're not. And that's at the very heart and soul of the problem you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the gigs are few and far between and the times are lean. It's that most of the work that you do in your lifetime will not be reimbursed. So you have to see the enormity of that and come up with any kind of a strategy you can. But I have to say, many of the people who study with me, just as I was when I was young, they're extremely poor, and so was I.
It's something that it's hard to prepare somebody for if they're not familiar with what it's actually going to be like.
They have dreams of making it as a performer. Every musician starts out with that. Well, here's one of the things that was operative even during those years, not commenting on any individuals when I say this. In order to stay out there and make your money as a performer the way that they did, but you would need to accept some compromise.
Yeah.
Because the gangsters, when they supported the art form, they didn't care if anybody else liked it.
Crazy.
They put their money behind the greatest musicians. So Roy Eldridge told me in the very early days, you could see a $100 bill in your tip glass. That's like a $1,000 bill. When it went over into the hands of the businessmen, they cared about the market more than the music. And the rest is history. the bassist, Eddie Gomez, who I've performed with, terrific guy and a truly great bass player. And to my great astonishment, because he's made his living performing, he said if he had it to do all over again, he would not do that. He would have another way of making a living. He would not do what he did, stay out there working professionally, because it separated him from the music that he knew about, that he would want to just be able to live that. And this is what the big dividing line is. It may not be that you will have to play rock, but you're going to have to compromise with the business people. They're going to want to have some input in what you record or what it is you present on their stage. So it's the difference between the market and the pure art that the money people. They have the idea that people can't handle great music, great art. They can't handle it. I've heard people say this in the business. But they're all wrong, because during the years that the gangsters put their money behind the people who they wanted, that's when the musicians went to ultimate fame and when this music was the dominant music. So Louis Armstrong, after Caruso maybe, he was the first international superstar. And Roy Eldridge, when he was playing at his greatest, was a featured star with Gene Krupa, you know, like they were pop stars. So now, all these many years down the road, with the money people having the say, jazz is at the bottom. People can handle great art. In fact, they want it. They're being starved. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Warren Smith,
percussionist drummer Warren Smith. Thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Very well.
And I was calling you, trying to get comments about working with Connie Carruthers and knowing Connie Carruthers, pianist.
All right. Well, I've known Connie for quite some time, actually. I've known about her for a long time, but I hadn't had the chance to play with Connie until maybe the last 10 years or so. I know she was around when some of the early movements with Lenny Tristano and people like that were happening. And for the last few years of his life, Connie and Max Roach were living together, and I got to know her a little bit better then because I was very close with Max. But even at that time, I hadn't yet had an opportunity to play with Connie extensively. And the last 10 years or so, during occasions with the Vision Festival and Art for Art's Sake downtown with William and Patricia Parker's productions, I've been able to kind of play with Connie quite a few times, and all I can say is it was really explosive. You know, Connie doesn't look like the kind of energy that she produces on the piano, and it kind of jumps out at you when you hear all this energy coming out of someone who is basically kind of soft-spoken and mild-mannered and not very, outwardly overly emotional. All of that comes out with her expression of music.
What is it that you can take from having worked with her?
Well, just an openness and a tolerance of ideas and directions and an ability to kind of adjust as you go along, which is what we who call ourselves creative musicians involved in creative music attempt to do all the time. And we're kind of surrounded by it in certain environments, particularly events like the Vision Festival and things like that. But Connie was very adaptable. I remember once a couple of years ago, my wife and I went to her loft. She was celebrating, I think, then her 70th birthday. And she and a dancer named Brenda Buffalino did a beautiful extemporaneous concert, like tap and piano, that was just mind-blowing, just very delicate and expressive. That just sticks out in my mind as one of the things that I heard her do. She was just really able to fit into wherever you put her.
Just like you.
I hope so.
Did you ever get a chance to record with Connie?
You know, I'm not sure. I know we've got a couple of video things that we've done. I never did a commercial recording with Connie, but the last few things that we did, there were people videotaping and recording. So I have an expectation that at some point some of that music might show up.
Well, thank you so much, Warren Smith, for sharing your thoughts. Is there something else you want to share before we move on?
Yeah, we're going to miss her. We're going to miss Connie, but we were enriched with her presence, and I certainly enjoyed working with her and being a friend.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Okay, you're quite welcome, Joyce. Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Patricia Nicholson Parker.
Patricia Nicholson Parker, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. It's unfortunate that it's under these circumstances, but I am grateful that you're available to share about Connie Carruthers.
It's always very nice to speak with you, Joyce. It's my pleasure to talk about one of the most wonderful people, most wonderful artists, and most wonderful human beings I've had the privilege to know. An amazing human being, artist.
How long have you known Connie Carruthers, and how did you meet?
Actually, relatively recently. I didn't know of her, about her, or anything until Jamil Munda hired her to play with him, shared the bill with her.
Thank you.
I'm thinking it was like 2007, 2006, something like that. And that was the first time I heard of her. And I thought of her, in as much as I knew of her, I thought of her as being more from a mainstream world. So it was interesting that Jamil brought her. But it was fine. It was more than fine. It was very good. I think I got to know her when Tonic closed. The venue Tonic on Norfolk Street closed, and I started holding meetings. And there were these issues. What are the issues that artists are facing when they lost that venue? What was so great was its centrality and the breadth of its booking, and that it could hold a lot of people. It was just a comfortable place, and people really liked it, but it became financially, it wasn't feasible, and it closed. She showed up, and she was also, the other issues is affordable housing and how that impacted artists, so artist housing. I think I invited her to speak. Someone said she was interested in it. I just realized rather quickly after that that she cared as much as anyone, much more than most, about other people, other artists, that she was willing to take responsibility for people. And not many people are, to shoulder, to care about not just their own or the few that they deal with, but really care about the whole community. She was into community in a very substantial, real way. And then she had this following of her students. And then you began to realize that her students weren't just students. They really were people who loved her because she was so supportive and was able to really give so much.
What did she teach?
Well, I assumed at first piano, but what she really taught was improvisation. Some of her students were pianists, but many of them were drummers, saxophone players, what have you. There's an example of her teaching that you can find on YouTube, which is impressive in the depth of understanding and the non-clinical approach, but a real whole approach to it, that she understood improvisation as more than just the way into the depth of the music, is a way into the depth of what art can be in a community, how art reaches and touches us, and how to access this sacredness through improvisation, and also your own personal, the artists themselves, that place in them, and how to communicate that with those. By knowing it in yourself, you can share it with others. It's not just music theory or nothing only technical, but her own, if you've ever heard her play, which I know you have, I mean, she had a formidable technique. Her technique came from her absolute love of the music. She just loved to play. She loved to practice. She loved to be inside the music. It was like a deep place.
How did you wind up featuring her this past summer for Vision 21 Festival?
Well, I think at a certain point, once I realized how special she was, I actually made it my business to make sure that she appeared in some way in every festival. Sometimes I made it subtle because I didn't want people to get annoyed, because, you know, people have this whole idea about what I should present and what I shouldn't. But when I first heard her, I assumed everyone that she was really well known and that people knew about her. But then I realized that she wasn't. And there's some people, it's really an honor to present them. And it's also something that you achieve through time. I mean, this depth of your creativity isn't something that you're born with. You can be born with incredible gifts, which are exciting and valuable at a very young age. But by the time you get to a certain age, if you've maintained your connection to the sacred origin of the art that flows through you, then by the time you're a certain age, even if you do that unconsciously, not using the languages like sacred, if you maintain a truthfulness in your art, by the time you get to a certain age, it's deepened and grown, and it's like this incredible gift that needs to be heard, seen, shared. So I made it my business to make sure she appeared in some way at every festival for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Then last year I was thinking, finally I could feel like there was some energy. Like whenever Connie played, people were showing up. Finally, she was beginning to be recognized. I was really happy about that. Over all this time, she'd come to every artist meeting, people who show up. She was like that. And that's like an expression of like that real commitment to community, to others. But above all of that, at the Evolving series in March, right towards the end, she was sitting outside the Grazzo Gallery where Evolving takes place. And she told me that she had been diagnosed with fourth stage terminal. And she told me situations around it, which the doctors not doing what they should have done at a certain time. But she said when the doctor came in and told her the diagnosis, she said she had this incredible feeling of freedom. And she was shining with this. The freedom she was referring to was both a freedom from having to do whatever the doctors were going to tell her to do. She wasn't going to do chemo or anything like that. She was going to do an alternative healthy treatment. She was free of them and their way of approaching things. And she was just free to be herself, And also, whatever came, came, whenever it came. But she was so unbelievably optimistic. It was not a negative at all. I really wanted to hang around for another couple of years, knowing that I couldn't hope for anything more than that. I was hopeful because she was hopeful. And so I was happy for her. I wasn't happy for the diagnosis.
Sure.
Happy for this beautiful gift that she received, the spiritual gift that she received in that moment. I had already booked her to do the salon with Henry Grimes on April something. It was sort of to prepare for the Vision Festival, but it was also, I wanted to do a salon with Connie. Connie loved Henry, so I thought it would work well. It totally worked beautifully. But the crazy, sad, but great thing that happened was she decided to go to Mexico for a treatment, and she would have had to go when they told her she was to go. But her day to go was the day after that salon.
Oh, wow.
Right. So the next morning, her dear friend Ken Ciliano and Andrea Wolfer took her to the airport. Even by then, she had gotten her diagnosis. It must have been 3 weeks or something like that, maybe four. So we were able to do this incredible salon, but she was already so much weaker and thinner. And then she went, and then I think she performed at the Vision Festival about 2 weeks after she got back. And then, and this I did think she was crazy, but I also supported it because I knew she had to do what she had to do. A week or so after the festival, she went to France to perform.
Wow.
To see her stepdaughters who live there. Yeah. And she was there, I think, for 2 weeks. I feel like when I saw her in the hospital, I looked out, she was on the bed smiling and talking. I said, she's an angel, and she still is.
Right.
And so I still feel like she's with me. She told me the last time she spoke to me, she told me she's going to keep bugging me to do what I was supposed to be doing. And I just love talking about her, but you have to.
Oh, thank you, Patricia Nicholson Parker, for sharing your remembrances about Connie Crothers. And I'm sure there's more to share, and there will be more that will be done in her honor.
Yeah.
But thank you for now.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye, sir.
All right, bye, Patricia. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Lewis Flip Barnes. How you doing?
Okay. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I can't complain. No use.
Lewis Flip Barnes, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and discussing Connie Crothers. When did you first meet Connie?
I met Connie Crothers face-to-face, I would guess at least like 10, 11, 12 years ago. But I knew about her work and her musicianship before then. so I was very aware of her and how she has contributed to creative music.
Chris Becker, who wrote the book Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, you had referred Connie Crothers to him. Why did you want to include Connie Crothers in this book?
Because in speaking to Chris and when he initially spoke about the project that he wanted to do, he was saying, hey, Flip, tell me some of the people in the so-called music hall jazz that you think are people that are bellwethers and some of the most creative forces. And Connie was one of the people that was foremost in my mind because Connie has always had a very, very interesting career and the way she contributed to this music, from being one of the people that came through the music of Lenny Tristano and just the way she's always been so open to all kinds of music and sounds. So I thought she would be a natural for the subject that he wanted to write about.
Were you playing with her when you met 10, 11, 12 years ago?
Yeah, here's the interesting thing. Connie and I would always see each other, especially through the Vision Jazz Festivals through the years. And about 5 years ago, or maybe 6 years ago, I said to Connie, we should collaborate and do something because I've been to your loft many a time in Brooklyn, and she would have these impromptu jam sessions where they would do variations of Tristano's music, where you would take themes like Pennies from Heaven, and of course they would have their variant heads to the tunes, and their alternate voicings for the changes for the tunes. But bottom line is that I played with her many a time in these impromptu jam sessions, and I said to Connie, it was at least 5 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I said, we should collaborate and do something together. I'd love to do something with you. She said, I'd love to do it, Flip. That was the thing about her enthusiasm. She said, let's do it. Oh, wow. Connie would like to do this with me. You know, I felt so honored. The initial idea started from me through the Vision Jazz Festival, because many times when I have not been playing in the Vision Jazz Festival, I would be the MC, and it seemed like many a time that she would perform, I'd end up being the MC that night, and I'd say, hey, Connie Crothers, you know, whoever she was playing with. And for different reasons, up until this year, we just could not get the timing or the venue. In fact, one time we were supposed to do a gig together, I guess 2 or 3 years ago, but the venue didn't have an acoustic piano. Connie didn't play electric piano, right, and I wouldn't ask her to do that.
So did you actually record anything together?
Well, as fate would have it, Connie and I did something this year as part of the whole Arts for Arts Evolving series, where Connie and I had the opportunity to perform together as a quartet with Michael Bisio and also with Warren Smith. We did two collaborations under the name of the Lewis Barnes Quartet, but it was really like group ensemble, where we did something, I think, in January or February, and then we did something in April. And we called the group Detuned because we took tunes and kind of took them apart and deconstructed them and then put them together as the creative energy and spirit pushed us forward. And it was recorded both as a video and also as an audio there at the Clemente Soto.
Velez.
Yeah, and it was great because the thing I loved about the musicians is that you didn't really have to have a rehearsal or say, okay, I won't do this or do that. I said, look, this is the general outline of what we want to do. I said, here too. Two tunes, first time we didn't hear two tunes, second time, when you start, you won't even know what the tune is in the traditional sense, and it'll all come together at the end. It's kind of like a meal that you have the ingredients, and then at the end, you're like, oh, you made a clam soup, but you didn't know it was a clam soup, because when it started, it was like, okay, well, you got some seasoning here, and maybe not even a clam. And her openness and her creativity. And it was like a dream come true for me, and I think that I know for a fact for everybody involved, because Michael Bisio, he couldn't agree to do it. Warren is Mr. Music, and I'm telling you, it was way better than I could have conceived it as far as what was accomplished. And a key reason for it is Connie. Her openness, her musicality, her understanding of all the forms that were going on, it was really something that was magical.
Is the recording available?
You know, we have it on Facebook. Both videos, both gigs are on Facebook. We did a Sam Rivers tune, Beatrice, that nobody knew was Beatrice until we got through with it.
Okay.
We did Baya by Throwing Smoke. We did a mix of Rudy My Dear and also Monk's Mood and also Green Chimneys. You never know what is going to happen when, but the way fate would have it, Connie and I have been trying to do this and we did it, and the next thing I know, she transitions.
So what can you say that you took away from having met Connie Crothers?
Connie Crothers, her spirit, her creativity, her understanding of the music, her openness. She was not caught in any kind of style. She was open to so many things, so many different forms. And in one moment, you could hear it being, quote, all the way in the pocket. And the next moment, it's totally, quote, out, whatever that means to people. But she had the facility also, as far as the musicianship, that she could do all of that. I think more than anything else, just her open mind approach to the music and not being hung up on any particular style, and openly and with enthusiasm contributing to making something different that adds to the tradition and also adds to the openness and where you can take it somewhere else. She was just such an enthusiastic spirit in making sure that we just add more to what's already been done.
Well, thank you, Lewis Flip Barnes, for sharing your experience with Connie Crothers, and we look forward to seeing you continuing the work.
I'm going
to
do it because, you know what, like Connie, you do it every single day and every single night and every moment that you are here in the way we know it until you depart, but do it until the end.
Thank you, Flip.
All right. Thank you, Joyce.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and we have been presenting a memorial broadcast for the pianist Connie Crothers. What we're listening to right now is from the Lewis Flip Barnes Quartet. This is from the Lewis Flip Barnes Personal Archives, recorded earlier this year as part of the Evolving Arts series that is offered by Arts for Art. The name of the group is Detune, and I call this Detune A because it was recorded on the first night, and it is the first selection that was recorded. Before that, we heard Deep Friendship, Jameel Moondock and Connie Crothers from 2. This is a 2013 Relative Pitch Records release. That's Jameel Moondock on alto sax and Connie Crothers on piano. Before that, we heard Creepin' In from Max Roach and Connie Crothers. Swish is the name of that release. That's a 1982 New Records release. Connie Crothers on piano, Max Roach on drums. Before that, we heard a YouTube video of guitarist Mary Osborne. It's from Art Ford's Jazz Party, and the performance was recorded in 1958. Before that was our On the Bandstand segment with associate producer Hank Williams. We'll be back on the air on September 4th. It's Labor Day weekend. And until then, you'll be able to see our On the Bandstand listings at sugarinmybowl.org. Thank you once again for the community of artists, organizers, activists, and this music that helped put this program together. And major thanks to Chris Becker. La Nueva Alternativa, coming up next. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Rhino, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.